So you have a itinerary and your love overlanding. You have plans to do it big on the trace and some super glamping. One idea, deep news and reviews, a podcast the first rate and here just for you. You don't have to think about it, join us and be about it. Something interesting we want to hear about it. Come on, let's talk about it. Welcome to Waypoint Overland's Random Waypoints Podcast.
Sponsored by Midland. Communication for every adventure. The industry leader in radio communication technology and innovation for over 50 years. Sponsored by MyMedic. Sponsored by Tembo Tusk. Sponsored by Shower Pouch. Sponsored by DeMoss Collective. Mission built and made for mobility. Sponsored by BrewTrek. Sponsored by Hard Impact Designs.
Always remember, the opinion you follow should be your own. Just consider the things stated here to be a second opinion from a complete stranger online.
How you doing, Mike?
I am doing well, Phil. It is getting warm, finally, out here on the East Coast, and a little humid today, actually. But summer in America. Lots of things going on.
And for the viewers and listeners, where are you?
Well,
because you could be anywhere.
Right. Well, currently I'm actually in Connecticut, so continuing, which I will be probably all summer, at least probably to the end of August, just building out my new Overland Expedition rig. And I had the opportunity to do some stuff this weekend, actually, kind of exciting because the prior weekend I did that Land Rover event, but this weekend I got to go out yesterday for like, oh, I don't know, we took the motorcycles on the backcountry, part of the backcountry discovery route here in New England. And a buddy of mine, Eric, and I took our motorcycles out, did some a bunch of different dirt roads and some gravel riding and some different stuff. And it's that time of the year. I you know, just excited to be able to be outside. And a little bit of a change for me riding the motorcycle up here in the trees and whatnot. And it's a little bit different than down in the sand and the dust in Baja, you know.
We need to interview the guys from BDR. That's pretty easy to do.
Yeah, let's make a note of that. I'd like to get some of those guys. I know most of them, so let's get them on here for sure.
And what did you think? How many miles did you do? It looked like it was a really short run.
Well, so we went out for like maybe 6 hours. We probably did 150 miles yesterday.
So we got a surprise guest. I hate to interrupt you. He hasn't popped up, but his name is there so far.
You see his name.
So until he pops up, continue. How many miles did you guys do?
About 160.
Hey! What's up, Ray?
Sorry, guys. I tried to log in and Zoom decided it needed to update everything in my system. So it took a while to get back in.
Oh, no, we were fine. We were discussing the world. We were solving the world's problems.
Awesome.
So, how are you, Ray?
Cut you off. You guys are just in the middle of a story, it sounded like.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to finish and then we're going to bring you in if that's okay, Ray.
Yeah, that's all good.
Okay. So again, how many miles did you do?
I don't know what the story was, but basically I was out on my motorcycle this past weekend and we were doing some of the backcountry discovery route here in New England. And, it wasn't all on that route, but the riding here in Southern New England in particular goes up in the Berkshires and whatnot is just absolutely beautiful out there. A lot of people don't realize this, how much of the roads are actually not paved. Like people think of that in certain areas of the country, but you'd be surprised on how many dirt roads there are in New England.
Well, that's why that was a lead-in question. I've done the New England BDR and I wanted to know how many miles you did to get your impression of it, because my impression is, I think that was probably the hardest one for them to figure out a path for. Like they're making a big deal about the Wyoming one that they just created, but I've done that before. It was actually Wyoming BDR. I mean, it was pretty much set in stone. It was there already. They had to piece together the one in New England.
Yeah.
And I think they did a good job.
Going through, you know, more populated areas for sure. It's sort of like if you take the route of the Appalachian Trail from Maine down to Georgia, you know, it's got to be a little bit pickier and choosier of what locations it goes through to avoid, you know, more densely populated areas for sure.
Okay, so now we're going to introduce our guest to those who don't know. This is Ray Hyland, and Ray Hyland is a member of the Explorers Club, and he's a fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographic Society. He's traveled the world with his family, and he's the face of the Overland Rally events, which are the BC Overland Rally and the Northwest Overland Rally. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be here.
Now, Ray, that's what I had written down. I'm going to give a little more introduction to you. I was, I'm pretty much going to say a little bit of what I was telling Mike before you got on. I like stand-up comedy. And I like it so much. I look at it from the technical aspect, too. I think you, if you had chose to, would have been a great stand-up comedian.
That's good to know. It's good to know I have something to fall back on.
So we're going to have comedy hour coming up here in about 10 minutes.
So I've set the bar. So he's got to, you know, meet it now.
Right, right.
Do you know anything about the submersible?
Yeah, quite a bit. A couple of friends on it. So we probably won't go into it in depth.
Wow. Okay. All right. Next subject. I'm sorry to hear that, Ray.
Yeah. You know, in the Explorers Club, you meet a lot of really interesting people, and everybody has their own passions that they want to pursue. And, you know, some of those passions can be hazardous. So you typically will hear of a few people, you know, passing on each year that you've met at various functions and get togethers.
Yeah, oftentimes that is the case. I mean, that's true of adventurers and explorers. They don't necessarily take the path of least resistance.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, you know, some people will look at something and go, I have no idea why someone would want to do that, risk their life and spend all that money. But I mean, it's the same story for, you know, people who climb Mount Everest. It's dangerous. It's expensive. People who want to, you know, save up and buy a big truck and drive around the world for a couple of years with their family. Maybe not as dangerous, but definitely not cheap, depending on how you do it. Everybody follows their own passion.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because Phil and I had that conversation last week talking about that. And I think I used that exact analogy with Mount Everest. Because I was sitting here going, wow, geez, if somebody gave me a choice, if I go underwater or I go to Mount Everest, I'm probably going to Mount Everest, but that's just me, you know?
So guys, since I have a Canadian and American with me, I think this might be a good subject to discuss. I just read that Canadians, percentage-wise, have a significantly... how do I want to word this? There are far more percentage-wise Canadians who own passports and have visited America and explored it than percentage-wise of Americans who have passports and have explored Canada. And I'm wondering why you guys think that is.
I think part of it is perception. I mean, America has a lot of great things to see, right? And Canada has a lot of natural beauty, places to explore. But I mean, America has the Grand Canyon and Disneyland and New York City. And so depending on who you are and where you want to go and what you want to do, there's something for everybody, right? You know, it, there's a certain percentage of people who want to go to Canada to explore the wide open places and see the culture and that type of thing. But a lot of what you can find in Canada, you can find in the U.S. So I think a lot of people don't feel the need to go out and explore, you know, outside of the lower 48 or even Alaska, unless they've really done a lot of exploration on their home turf. And then they're like, all right, now it's time to see something new. Now it's time to start crossing borders, right? And then on the other hand, I mean, you know, a lot of Canadians have passports because it's economically convenient to go to the U.S. as well, right? I mean, you look at 90% of the Canadian population lives within 100 miles of the U.S. border, right? And, you know, if you want to go buy cheap gas or cheap groceries, or you want to order something from Amazon and get it delivered at the U-Ship, you know, mailbox right across the border, a lot of Canadians take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's true.
Are you near any wildfires?
Not today. there were some close by about 2 weeks ago, but they're under control now. But yeah, the most of the ones that you're seeing on the news are up in northern Alberta. Those ones are mostly under control. And then there's a lot of stuff going on in Ontario and Quebec and in the Maritime provinces. So mostly on the East Coast. I'm in British Columbia. So we're pretty good right here, right now.
Well, a large portion of America is expecting a heat wave this coming week. Mm-hmm. And I just want to remind our listeners and viewers to hydrate, especially our travelers and nomadic people. Make sure that you are carrying enough water. Mike, you're an advocate on any overland bill should concentrate. One of its focuses should be water. Do you want to speak on that?
Well, I always tell people when you're building out a truck, whether it's small or big like one of mine, that you know you're really looking at three things: comfort of your own personal self and how you like to travel. And, you know, the two things that go along with that are your water generally and power, right? Without water and power, it's, you know, how much survival. So water is a big one. And I think a lot of people overlook that sometimes, for sure. And speaking about Canadian fires, that's affecting us over where I am here. We've been getting just slammed by smoke. I mean, we haven't really seen the sun in weeks here, largely from the Ontario and Quebec fires. So it's been bad. In fact, a bunch of my friends were doing the Ironman at Mount Tremblant got canceled this weekend because the air quality is so poor.
Yeah, it's been a brutal season and a lot earlier in the season than typically.
Yeah, much earlier. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, heat is something that a lot of people play with. And I just want to remind people that extreme heat kills more people in the United States than any other weather hazard.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you, a random question for you, Ray.
All right.
Therapy or travel?
I think travel is a form of therapy. Right? You get away, you get to reevaluate, you get to bring yourself away from all the busyness and all the stresses and all the inputs that are influencing you on a day-to-day basis. And it's a way to reset yourself mentally and physically.
What do you think, Mike?
Agreed. I mean, my therapy is travel. My therapy really is interaction with people. I mean, different places and different cultures and just getting out there. And I think by definition, humans are social animals, right? I think we all like to be alone and solitary sometimes, but you can only do that so much. So it's the interaction, I think, is therapy.
Yeah, for sure.
I agree. I 100% agree. I think that the COVID made more people realize that travel can be a form of therapy. More people had the opportunity to have long spaces of time where they were able to travel. Some people had never had the opportunity to travel for any length of time and were able to do it. And I think now that the world is starting to come back, that a lot of people need therapy because they aren't able to travel. Most people that I speak to, guys, I interview a lot of people, and I'm seeing a lot of people going through, I would say, a sort of a psychosis, going back to work after not working for 6 months, a year, whatever. So that's why I asked that question. I do believe that travel is a form of therapy. A lot of people got it recently, and now it's been taken away.
It's interesting how different types of travel and the way you focus on it can affect different people positively. we've been supporting the Veteran Overland group for a number of years now at our rallies, and a great bunch of guys. And one of the things that they do is they use overlanding as a way of helping vets who come back into civilian life reintegrate. And, you talk to a lot of guys when they come out of the military, one of the biggest things that they miss is that sense of camaraderie, of being in a really tight knit team, working together, focusing on an objective, as a group, overcoming an obstacle and meeting your objective. And so the guys from Veteran Overland will get teams together, and they'll have an objective. We're going to go from here to here, and we're going to work together. There's going to be a whole bunch of adversity. It's not an easy trip. The team has designated roles. We work together. It's a multi-day trip. We overcome these obstacles, whether we need to cross a river, build a bridge, get through a huge bog, whatever we need to do. But we overcome these obstacles, and then at the end, you have this sense of accomplishment. You've reached that goal. You challenged yourself. You overcame these obstacles with a team of comrades. And it's been really valuable to a lot of people. So, it's a great example of how travel in various ways can definitely add, huge therapeutic benefits.
There needs to be more of that. I am a person who never served in the military, never would have served in the military, had no desire. But I'm able to do that because there are so many people who have volunteered to do that. So I feel like no matter what your stance is about war or whatever, you owe those who did. I'm able to say and do what I want. I'm able to choose whether I want to go to war or not because others did. And that's everyone. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to two people who have been part of the Overland community before this big...
before it was called Overland.
Right. I have a question for both of you. 25 years from now, will overland travel be as popular as it is now? Has it reached its plateau? Where do you see the next 25 years?
Yeah, I think it's going to be the same. Only because I think you have to put the world in general in perspective, right? So, I know from my days of traveling to many developing countries, some of them are 75 years probably behind, say Canada and the US. So, in 25 years from now, they won't even be at the level that we're at necessarily today from a infrastructure, from an organizational standpoint. In some cases, I mean, there's obviously some improvements that are happening at a much more rapid pace, like cell phone and internet coverages and certain things like that. But using your definition of overlanding, am I going to be able to say drive through the Pan American Highway in South America in 25 years from now? Sure. Absolutely. And do I think it'll be worth it then? Yeah, I do.
Yeah. I think we're going to have, overlanding as a concept still happening and still being popular. I think the challenges will be different. Mm-hmm. I think the infrastructure may be, a bit more developed depending on where you go. Some of the, and Michael will see this too, I mean, some of the underdeveloped nations that we've seen in the past are rapidly developing, especially roads and highways and stuff. And that's traditionally been driven by economic opportunity, right? So you have a lot of international firms looking at opportunities to invest in roads, railroads, you know, hub and spoke systems in developing markets so that they can access those economic benefits, right? So that changes the nature of the travel a bit. So we may have less of the technical slash off-road side to deal with. But we're still going to have the interesting challenges of navigating different cultures. We're still going to have the challenges of different perspectives of, as we travel around the world. So I think, you know, that the, you know, overlanding, I think, is still going to be popular. I think it's going to migrate. It's going to evolve, but it's still going to be there.
And we might all be doing it with electric vehicles.
Right. I'd be actually honestly surprised if we weren't. Yeah, so.
For sure.
We all know Emily Miller here, right? Rebel yeah. Rally. Okay. I just wanted to, Toyota is renewing a commitment to the Rebel Rally and sending 20 rigs or 20 team members to the next Rebel Rally. I just wanted to mention that. We try to cover a little news on here too, Ray.
Well, I mean, that's great to hear. I mean, the Rebel is a fantastic organization. You know, and there are people who don't really understand the Rebel, and they think it's, you know, it's the girls' version of, you know, a time, speed, distance rallying. Whereas the reality is it's the longest and hardest race of its kind in North America. It just happens to not have any guys racing in it. And so it's an amazing competition. And Emily and the whole team have done a wonderful job. We've been really lucky. We've kind of co-hosted the Rebel U events at our shows. And I got to say, the women who come to these events, right, and come and train for it, they train hard. I mean, it's no joke. They're out there learning, you know, pencil and compass navigation and, you know, managing time and getting in there and getting dirty and fixing cars in the middle of the desert. And yeah, it's pretty hardcore. It's great to see.
Yeah, definitely.
I agree with everything you said. I like to mention them any chance that I get. I'll put the people who train and go through Rebel Rally up against any man.
Yep.
So since you talked about Rebel U, and that is it going to be at BC Overland also?
Yeah. Each of the Overland rallies, there is a Rebel U component integrated into the schedule. Some of the classes are open to anyone. So navigation, basic and advanced navigation, for example, that's a class that, you know, anybody can enter and learn from regardless of age or gender. They do have some specific ladies only classes as well.
And could you briefly explain to the viewers and listeners what the Northwest Overland Rally is and how it started?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, people who are familiar with Overland Expo, you know, they understand the concept. It's you know, it's a multi-day event. People go and they camp. You get a chance to meet vendors, take a lot of classes, meet some inspiring speakers. The rallies are very similar. Except that when we developed the rally series, we wanted them to be more, I guess democratic is the word, but not in the modern sense, but more in the traditional sense, right? We wanted an opportunity for everybody to be able to go to a great event like that, have world-class training and speaking opportunities. So rather than you having to make a migration to a big event, we decided to start smaller events in regional areas. And we have a lot of the same instructors who come, you know, the guys who run the off-road training programs for the Expo series are the same guys that run all of our classes. We have a lot of the same vendors, but at the same time, we also have a lot of local vendors and local personalities and people who are part of the community. And that's really what makes it different and makes it special. So if you go to the Northwest show, or you go to the BC show, or the Rocky Mountain show that we held in Colorado, or even the shows that we started up originally over in the East Coast, and that those are opportunities for local shops, local trainers, local vendors to interact with the community. You know, there are people who will just, you know, they want to outfit their truck, they go onto Expedition Portal, or they pick up the Journal or Outdoor by Four, and they look at the ads and see who's there, and they're ordering stuff and they're asking questions. They don't realize that there are amazing experts in their own backyard. So, you know, you can be living in Seattle or Oregon or Kamloops or somewhere, and you can take your truck or your Jeep or your van into literally a world-class shop and ask detailed questions and talk through your build with somebody and get people to help you work on your vehicle. And so this is an opportunity for people to connect with those experts in their own hometown or in their local area. So then I think the second thing is we try to make it a little bit more casual. So, you know, I think Matt Scott was the one who said, I don't understand why you have to dress up like a lion tamer to go camping. So we try to make sure that it's all about just being fun and casual and happy. And it doesn't really matter what truck you have, and it doesn't really matter what gear you have. Just get out there and have a great time, explore the world, see what's around you. And there's no pressure, and there's no snobbery involved. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. We have a ton of kids. We have a ton of new people who've never been into it before. We have a ton of retired people who've, you know, they've said, I want to go out and see the world, but I don't see myself as a snowbird driving a 40-foot diesel RV. You know, I want to buy a camper and go and explore and have fun and still have adventures. So yeah, the crowd's really mixed. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes it so special.
And out of the series, the Northwest Overland Rally is the original or the first, right?
That's right. Yeah, we've been doing that for about a dozen years now. Obviously, we had to take a couple of years off for COVID. But yeah, it's been going the longest, and it's a lot of fun. It doesn't really feel like an event anymore. It feels more like a family reunion when we have it every year. We have people that we've seen their kids coming to the show before they knew how to drive, and the kids learned how to drive in their parents' 4x4 on our technical course with the instructors. And then, you know, 5-10 years later, we see their kids building their own trucks and going out and driving down to Baja for 2 months. And it's pretty awesome to see that happen.
And you mentioned family. Like I, for years now, you've had a class called Family Spotting.
Right.
And now I see that, because, you know, I go to a bunch of events.
Okay.
Now I see that other places. Well, I see a bunch of stuff from your event now at other places.
Right.
And just so you know, I bet you don't remember when we first met.
It's been a while. You better remind me.
You don't.
I totally don't.
So 10 years ago, I was driving through Plain. I had been living there for a couple of years already. Not Plain, but in Washington.
Yeah.
And I was basically exploring, just driving around. And I happened to just drive past the day before your first one there. And you were across the street talking to like five guys. And we started talking. Is that me?
No, that's mine.
Okay. You explained to me what the event was, and then I came to the event the next day.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, now I remember having that conversation with you, but that's a while ago, man. I'm amazed that you remember that.
Well, I've been chronicling this whole thing since I first started. So I remember everybody I've met. And like I'm always telling Mike, I don't consider myself as nobody. I'm a fanboy of this thing. So I remember everybody, because you were telling me about some of the places you had been and things like that. I remember all of that stuff because I enjoy hearing it. I enjoy people telling me their stories. I enjoy living vicariously through other people's adventures, even though I try to have my own. I'm just a big fanboy. And I haven't missed one except for, you know, obviously the one during the COVID. And it's gotten better and better, in my opinion. And you've never heard me say this to you, but if you go through my social media over the years, I've repeatedly over and over and over again told people that my favorite, I put the Overland Expos in their own little box. They're their own unique thing.
Yep.
You are number one of all the rest, in my opinion, the Northwest Overland Rally. I haven't been to the BC one, but that doesn't count anyway because that's in Canada. But the United States, I rated as the number one consistently.
Thanks, man. That's awesome to hear.
And you have, I just mentioned it, you have one in BC, right?
Yep. Yeah, coming up on the 20th of July.
Which I'll be definitely attending. Could you tell a little bit about the BC Overland Rally?
So the BC Rally is very similar to the Northwest. You know, we try not to break the secret sauce. It's all about, you know, families and friends and getting together. We have the same tagline, which is have fun, make friends, learn stuff, in that order. And the BC site is great. I mean, it's we're lucky in that in BC we have a the venue is a couple hours away from Vancouver. It's pretty close to the border for people who are driving up for it. But it's in a little town called Merritt, BC. We've got a big flat field. It's probably 50 acres. A flat field right beside a big, well, not a big river, a small river. River you can walk out in. It's up to your knees kind of thing in the summertime, which is nice. So it's a refreshing dip on a hot day, but you're not worried about getting swept downstream. And, but yeah, we've, you know, mountains on one side and big hills, trees and river on the other side, really pretty venue. The ranch itself is about, I think it's 800 acres. So there's tons of opportunity for people to just go out and explore on the ranch, lots of little valleys and stuff. You know, wild horses running through the long grasses. It's a pretty special spot. So we're kind of blessed with where we've ended up. We started out in the Sasquatch Ski Resort, which we were there for 2 years. We outgrew it. We moved to Whistler. We were in the Whistler Olympic Park for a while, and we outgrew that venue. And now we've ended up at this place up in Merritt, and we're really excited about this new venue. This will be our second year there. So it's pretty cool. It allows us to build, like the Northwest show, we're able to build a technical terrain track into the forest on one end of the field. And so that can stay there year after year. And each year we just continue to improve it. And so that's really kind of cool.
So I have a question about the BC Overland. Is it going to have the same features as the other? Like, are there going to be trails people are going to go on, off-road trails and stuff like that?
Yep, I think so. What we'll probably be doing for BC is most of the trail rides during the show itself. We'll be on the ranch, just opportunities to get out there, see a little bit of the ranch land around you, take a lot of pretty pictures, that kind of thing. Nothing too technical, nothing too hardcore. We work in the BC show. We've been working for years with the Four-Wheel Drive Association of BC. And that's a great volunteer organization in BC. I think there's like 40,000 members, which is pretty huge, given the small population of the province. But that organization works really aggressively to maintain road access throughout the province. So not only do they educate people in treading lightly, but they also do a lot of trail maintenance work every year. And they partner with the provincial government to do, you know, typically an annual improvement project. So that could be restoring an old fire lookout tower on the top of a mountain somewhere. It could be rebuilding a recreation site, putting in like a big log cabin lean-to or something like that in an isolated lake somewhere in the interior. So it's a great organization. So we're working with some of the guides from the Four-Wheel Drive Association to do guided trips in and out of the event. And that's something we did for the first year this year at Northwest. So Northwest, on the Thursday, you know, vendors come in and set up in the morning. And then attendees start arriving in the afternoon. So what we did this year was attendees could meet in a remote location somewhere and then take a backcountry trail all the way through the day. And then the afternoon they arrive at the venue. So you're not just driving the highway all the way to get there. And then the same thing on Sunday morning when we wrap up in the morning, attendees were able to pack up their gear, join a technical trail or technical trail ride, you know, and join somebody and go off and spend a few hours, you know, or half a day or most of a day on a longer trail run, which would take them off, you know, and eventually they come out near Seattle or Portland or somewhere, right? But the idea there is that, you know, you get to do a long trail ride. You get to experience part of the local terrain, you know, the local country you don't really get a chance to see with people who know the area really well. But you're not losing an entire day of all the activities that are at the show.
That's kind of similar to one of the features that I always state about Northwest Overland Rally that I like personally. The BDR basically runs through the Northwest Overland Rally. Yeah. I have on several occasions left a few days early, drove all the way down to the Oregon border, taken the BDR back up, went to Canada, came back and then came to the Northwest Overland Rally. Beautiful trip, almost all off road. So I just wanted to mention that.
We do have a lot of people who take the BDR to and from the Northwest show. That's kind of become a tradition for a lot of people. It's a lot of fun. This is an opportunity for people to take something a little less hardcore. It's just a one-day trip, and it's with somebody who knows the area really well. So, you know, it gives them a chance to explore something that they haven't seen. And even if they don't know the way themselves, they get introduced to some new terrain.
So, Ray, you're just a businessman that saw an opportunity. You don't know anything about overland, and you've never done any travel or anything like that, right?
Not at all. Nope. Never been off pavement before.
Okay. So,
yeah.
We're joshing. Just give a quick little rundown of your travels, please. And not quick. You can talk as long as you want. I'm going to enjoy hearing it.
Honestly, I think this has kind of been in my blood. You know, if you look at the map of Western Canada, you'll see like up north in the Yukon on the Alaska Highway, you'll see the Highland Provincial Park and the Highland River and the Little Highland River. Those are named after my grandfather and my dad, who were early explorers in the north of Canada. My granddad was an explorer and photographer up north in the 40s and 50s. And so some big areas were named after him. And then my dad had the same sort of, you know, itchy feet, as he always called it, like to get out and see the world and explore. And I think, you know, from the time I was old enough to toddle around a campfire, I've kind of grown up, you know. I think at the beginning I was in the back of, we had an old Fargo delivery van that we used to go and explore the backcountry with back in the days before people were really building hardcore 4x4s. And yeah, I've just kind of grown up with it. When I was working in Singapore, when I first met my wife, we bought our first Land Rover, and that's been a love-hate relationship ever since, I think, as any Land Rover fan will know. But yeah, we started exploring with the local Land Rover Club over there. We ended up doing a lot of, you know, day trips into the local jungles and stuff around Singapore, and then eventually into Malaysia, up into Thailand and beyond. And when we moved back to North America, we brought one of my race trucks back. And that's been a lot of fun. It's a Defender 110, a little diesel truck. I have a set of tracks for it for going off into the mountains in snow season, which is a ton of fun. It has an AT Habitat camper on the top. And it's the only one on a Rover in the world. And after Mario built it for me, he said he'd never build another one. So I'm lucky I got it when I did. But yeah, we like to go everywhere. We've taken the kids on amazing adventures. We've been down through Mexico and up into the Arctic with a variety of inappropriate vehicles. And I think the biggest one we did as a group was in 2015. I bought an old Land Rover for about $300, well, Canadian dollars. So it's about $225 US. It had been sitting in a field for about 20 years and didn't run, no glass, no seats, dragged it home with my kids. I was working with Scott Brady at the Overland Journal at the time, and he looked at the pictures and he said, "Man, that is one heck of a project." He says, "I don't think you're going to get that running." And yeah, we ended up getting it running, and I found some old seats for the front and bought some secondhand glass for it. And in the back, I went to the Auto Wrecker and I found a bench seat out of a Chevy Astro van, which I threw into the back with some seat belts for the kids. And I think the first time I got it running, we took it around the block and it caught on fire, and managed to put the fire out, fix the wiring. And we promptly put it in a box and we sent it to London. And we flew over there and we got in it. And then we spent the next 9 months driving this terrible little truck from London all the way to Singapore. And so we drove all the way through Europe and through the Middle East and down into the Emirates and Oman and India and all, you know, over the Burma hump and down through Southeast Asia and eventually made it into Singapore. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a great little adventure.
Well, Mike, you're being a little too quiet. This is up your alley.
Oh, yeah, listen, I'm just enjoying the story. I completely understand what he's saying when he says love-hate relationship, though. I like that word.
Yeah, I have too many. I think I have 8 Land Rovers right now. So, yeah.
And what is the oldest one?
1954, Series 1. And that's the one we drove from London to Singapore.
They're not even comfortable to drive to the dump.
Do you still have that one? I know you used to bring it in to the Northwest Rolling Route.
I still have it. I finally decided to take pity on it, and I sent the engine in for rebuilding. And but, you know, it's hard to get parts for those things. So the engine has been with the rebuilder for a couple of years now. He promises me it's going to be fixed by this fall, and I should be able to put it back together over the winter. So fingers crossed. We'll see how that goes. He's been saying that for a few years now, so...
What year is yours, Mike?
My current one is a 1965. It's a 2A.
Nice.
And that's my oldest Land Rover that I've not the oldest Land Rover I've owned, but the longest running Land Rover that I've owned. I've had it for just about 30 years now.
Nice. And that's got the 2 1/4 in it.
That's a 2 1/4. Yep.
Nice. Yep. That's a great engine.
That's the truck that I took across Africa with.
Fantastic.
It's amazing. I was reading some article about about Land Rover, and basically anywhere that's been discovered, there's been a Land Rover there.
Yeah, I think I read a version of that quote that said, for most of the world's populations, the first vehicle they've ever seen was a Land Rover.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the three most recognizable brands, I think at one point, were Land Rover, Coca-Cola, and Kodak were like the three brands that people that, you know, would recognize in most countries.
I can see that.
Okay. I've got the most disrespectful question for both of you guys.
Okay.
What is wrong with you?
There's something.
Why do we like Land Rovers? Is that what you mean?
Yes, explain it. And I'm being funny. I've got two notable Land Rover owners. Please explain to me the obsession, not just yours, but in general, the community. Explain.
I think there's a couple of things there. One is, I mean, like if you grew up in the US, you grew up with Jeeps, typically. The rest of the world grew up with Land Rovers, right? That's part of it. And then those of us of a certain age will remember growing up as kids watching the Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom series on TV, right? And you'd have these brave guys standing on the hoods of old series Land Rovers chasing gazelles through the savannah, right? And jumping with nets. And it was ridiculous. And I remember my brother and I pretending we were these guys jumping off the couch trying to net the family dog, right? When mom wasn't around. Yeah. So, you know, there's those kind of memories, right? That kind of help you along. But I think the other thing is that a lot of the Land Rover clubs around the world are very interesting in that you have people who are fans of the brand and they like to get their fingers dirty and they like to tinker with old trucks and the simple technology that's behind them. And you'll go to a Land Rover club gathering, and you might have 10 guys sitting around the campfire or whatever chatting, and you'll have brain surgeons and architects and plumbers and ditch diggers and photographers. And it doesn't really matter what your background is, what your economic status is. It seems to bring together, I would say it's a community of masochists, for lack of a better word sometimes. But yeah, guys who or not just guys nowadays and people in general, there's a lot of interesting women out there running amazing expeditions in their Land Rovers around the world. But it does bring together people who seem to have almost like a romantic view of overland travel, right? It goes back decades, right? The kind of classic images that we see. And, and of course you've got things like the Camel Trophy and stuff like that that helped perpetuate that image for decades, right? So I don't think any other brand really got that as well as Land Rover did for many, many years. I think today Land Rover is moving away from that image, but for many years that was the traditional Land Rover image, right? Mike, what do you think?
Well, I agree. It's the iconic. It's that look. So if you think about it, most brands change the look of vehicles and the technology behind them pretty frequently. And if you look at a Series 1 Land Rover from, originally from 1948, and then you look at a Defender 90, let's say in, the early 2000s, it basically is the same truck. It didn't change very much. So it doesn't matter whether it's a 1973 or a 1988, or they look the same. So over all that time, people I know driving around, because I've had many Defenders and Series trucks, and nobody knows the difference. Most people don't really recognize whether or not it's a Defender or a Series. It's the same thing. It's a Land Rover. So they recognize that iconic shape, as I think is a lot of it. And then the people, like you were saying, the people that you run into. I went to a Land Rover event last weekend, so it was it's interesting because you'll get every walk of life there, but they all, if everybody show a fingernails, you all look like you were climbing in a cave all day, and it's just the way it is, and we call it the love hate, but it's sort of a. My Land Rover, the one that I have right now here in the garage, it there's nothing great about it. Like, it was almost miserable to drive. I had to drive 6.5 hours to this event. By the way, it's only 230 miles, and it took me 6.5 hours each way. But and I hadn't done it in a long time, but it brought back so many memories of, getting carbon monoxide poisoning and having the right side of my shoe melt off on the transmission tunnel housing. And, I've done it. And then, halfway into the trip, I was like, oh my God, how the hell did I drive across Africa in this piece of garbage? But there's some kind of weird love affair with that. And, maybe it's because it's so basic, but the thing has never stranded me anywhere. Like, even at the point of, you could strap a gas can on the top of your tire on the hood and just let it flow. If your fuel pump goes, there's all sorts of ways to fix the thing. I've got bushings in that truck that have been in there for 15 years now that I duct taped, and because they weren't the right size to fit in. So I put a bunch of duct tape in there. We jammed that bushing in there, and it's been like that. I haven't bothered to fix it, but it still goes. It's just so basic, And I think that maybe is what the Land Rover thing about. And I agree, the newer ones, I've had, right before I left to, on my current 3-year trip around the world, I sold my, I guess it was a 2020, maybe 2019 Range Rover. So they've certainly, the brand has moved away. In fact, lately you heard that announcement that they were, which I guess they've reneged on now. They were gonna basically get rid of Land Rover and call it the Defender, the Discovery, and the Range Rover, and not use the Land Rover icon anymore. Which, of course, everybody was like, "Huh?" And I guess they've gone back on that now. So, thankfully, but we'll see.
I think another part of it is that Land Rovers just look cute. Right? Yeah. Like, I mean, there's something about a little Land Rover, you know, like an old series truck, especially one that has the top off or the canvas sides rolled up, and you just, you know, they don't go very fast. They're not very loud. They're not very threatening. They just kind of trundle into town, and everybody smiles when they see it. Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember I did a motorcycle trip through England years ago, and I was on a 1954 Triumph, right? An old T100. Mm-hmm. And I'm riding through this one little tiny coastal sea village down in the south of England. And there was a guy in front of me on a bright new Ducati, right? Big red race bike. And he had a full set of matching race leathers and the helmet, and the bike was loud. And as he was riding through, and I was about, you know, 50 yards behind him, riding through this little village. And I'm on this ancient British motorcycle, and it's just putting along, and I've got an old leather, you know, brown leather jacket on, and an open face helmet, and, you know, and just a pair of jeans. And I noticed as I was going through the village that every person who looked at him, they just scowled at him. Right? Who is this hooligan who's invading our town? And I came trundling by on this classic old motorcycle, and everybody smiled and waved. Right. And if I'd stopped for gas somewhere, and every time I stopped to get petrol, you know, I had to go get a cup of tea because it would have vapor lock. I wouldn't be able to start it again for 20 minutes. Right. But I mean, you know, every time I'd stop somewhere, these old guys would come up and they go, oh, you know, Sonny, I had one of those when I was in college, you know, and then they'd start telling me stories. And I think it's the same thing with the old Land Rovers. People love to come up. You stop anywhere and people come up and they tell you about the first time they saw a Land Rover.
Yeah.
About, you know, stories about the brand and their history with their family, or just, you know, wow, is that one of those old Land Rovers? I've only seen them on television, right? I mean, we were at a car show yesterday in my little town, and I brought a couple of the Defenders down. And, you know, a lot of the older generation came up and said, wow, it's nice to see these still on the road. But a lot of young guys came up and said, what is this? This is cool. I've never seen one of these before, right? And that was actually kind of fun, too, you know, explaining what the truck was to, you know, these kids that were 16, 17 years old.
Yep.
All right. Let's get into some politics. Don't panic, guys. The weekend that Northwest Overland Rally had their event was the same weekend that they had the 75th anniversary jubilee, whatever celebration for Defender. I would have thought that you guys were doing a jubilee event at the Northwest Overland Rally, considering how many Land Rovers were at the event. It was just crazy.
I know. I kept saying that. Phil kept posting stuff from the, you know, I was at the Land Rover event, and he kept posting. I go, well, man, I got another one going on out there.
I could keep posting for weeks. I still haven't shown you all the photos.
It's cool. Honestly, we should have. I just forgot about it. I completely forgot that it was the same weekend.
So Here's the politics part of it. I talked to a bunch of the owners, and I mentioned about the event on the East Coast. And there was a consensus that since this was the 75th year, Jubilee Diamond, a big deal event, that, yeah, it had to be in one place, the main one, but there should have been like a traveling something. There should have been more than one event. There should have been at least an East Coast event, a West Coast and an East Coast event.
I don't know how official it would be, but I know there were a lot of little regional events. I know that our local Land Rover Club in BC, they had a big event on Vancouver Island. So they had, you know, a few dozen trucks over there. And they, you know, they had a big field, and they did the 75, you know, number made out of trucks on the field, and took some cool drone shots of it. I think, you know, you'd be surprised at how many little regional events actually were happening.
Oh, they discussed that, but they were saying that Land Rover should have.
Well, see, I mean, one of the advantages here on the East Coast is, so Anarch, who put that on, I was one of the, you know, kind of organizers of that 25 years ago. Well, we did this event 25 years ago at Greek Peak at the ski resort that it was at this year. And it was, you know, it was a combination of clubs, and the East Coast clubs are very active. Not that there definitely are West Coast clubs that are active too, but many of these East Coast ones have been active for a very long time. And you got to remember that Land Rover is in New Jersey, right? So corporate is out here. So it's very close for them to drive to support stuff on the East Coast, I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah, and their PR agency is based in New York City. Yeah, you know, so they know the East Coast really well.
Yep.
All right, so you guys are completely fine with that. I thought I could get something going here.
Well, I mean, you got like, you do have some West. I mean, Anna, I don't know because I'm not active in it any longer. But ANARC, which stands for Association of North American Rover Clubs. I mean, I believe there are West Coast clubs that are part of that now. I don't know. I think Sally Hall Society, it's some of the Colorado ones. But I don't know. But yeah, you're not going to, I guess you're not getting us riled up here, Phil.
Yeah, we've all, I mean, that's one of the things I think I like about the Land Rover Clubs is that you have all these individual little clubs. And people who know each other and I mean, you know, these old cars, they require a lot of wrenching, a lot of spare parts, a lot of connections. And that's the great thing about having all these little local clubs is that somebody will go, all right, well, you know, my Solex carburetor, you know, just hit the bucket, you know what I mean? So who's got a rebuild kit? And a couple of guys who live within an hour of them will put their hands up and they'll volunteer to come over and, you know, okay, I'll come over and I'll help you show you how to rebuild a carburetor this weekend. You know, all you have to do is supply the beer. And so it's great. There's all those little local connections. I think that's one of the things that makes the community special.
Yep. Yes.
So last week, me and Mike were discussing, and now you can settle this for us, about there's a similarity to your logo to the Defender.
Oh, I said it looked like the Camel Trophy a little bit.
Yeah.
The BC one.
Yeah.
Was that by design?
Yes, it was. I'm a big Camel Trophy fan. And since Camel's not using the logo anymore, that's inspiration. No, but I mean, we've, if you look at all of the rally logos that we've had, right, the ones for the different events over the years, we've always kind of been inspired by the classic kind of European moto rally logos, right? The Monte Carlo rally and the Mille Miglia and all those classic, you know, Paris Dakar, you know, London Peking, right? There's a classic shape and look to those logos that we've kind of emulated over the years. And that's been a lot of fun. And so, yeah, when we did the BC one, we just kind of pushed it a little further. But that's the same shape that Camel Trophy actually followed when they put their original logo together as well.
Yep.
Ray, will you be at the Pacific Northwest Expo over the next month?
I don't think I'm going to be able to, just because we're getting ready for the BC show, and it's a busy time of year. And when I'm, between running these shows, I still have to do my day job. So my boss only lets me take so many days off a year. So,
what about you, Mike?
What was the question?
Will you be attending Overland Expo Pacific Northwest?
I will be. I'm flying in there. This will be the first Overland Expo that I'm at that I am not with a truck. So I'm kind of actually excited about that. But I'm flying in next Wednesday, actually. Yeah. Yep.
So I didn't tell you. I probably shouldn't be saying this on an Overland podcast. But I extended my hotel for the entire time.
Wow, you know, Phil, I'm shocked. No,
I gotta say, when you're at a huge, you know, event, and you get a couple of thousand people camping, and you tell people that you have a hotel with a hot shower in it, suddenly become the most popular person around the campfire.
That's right. Yep, you're smart. Yep. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm looking forward to it because, you know, the Overland Expo. To go back to what you guys were saying earlier about, you know, bringing events that are a little bit smaller and a little bit more family reunion oriented. That's how Expo used to be back in the day, you know, when it was in the early years back down at like Mormon Lake or whatever. But, you know, it's so difficult now because it's so big, particularly, you know, for me, where I have a truck that's in a showcase section where, you know, people are just touring it nonstop and I'm an instructor. And, you know, and you're talking to people and you're having that family reunion thing, which is why I go anyways to go see people that I, haven't seen in a while. So it's just gets so overwhelming after a weekend, particularly when we just did the, you know, the Flagstaff one, which was, what did they say, Phil? It was like 35,000 people or something came through there.
It's I just thought crazy. It was 33, but it may be 35.
Maybe 30, whatever it was. It's a lot. And so I'm kind of super excited about being more one dimensional at this one, where I, you know, I can teach some classes, but most of the time I can just wander around and I don't have to worry about a truck.
Yeah, that's actually kind of nice. So I try to make it to at least one of the expos every year. And for me, it's fantastic because I get to walk around and just meet all these old friends that I haven't seen for a while, especially the vendors. And I'm not wearing any official hat. I get to just walk around and chat with people. And that's always really nice. Enjoy a show and not work it for a change.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how the expos evolve, or if they evolve with the new ownership. Because, you know, like you said, when they started out, you know, with Jonathan and Roseanne starting the first one in Prescott, there was 100 people there total, right? Everybody sat down for dinner together. The entire show sat down, attendees, vendors, everybody. And then when it went down to Amato, you know, slowly got bigger. Mormon Lake got bigger again, up into Flagstaff. And then, you know, when it was bought out by Lodestone, right? Again, the people who bought it was a family who bought the show, right? Yeah. And, you know, and you know, great people who bought it, the Kirchner family, they used to run the Pomona Off-Road Expo, right? So they understood the industry. Now that it's been bought again by a huge multinational event company that runs hundreds of shows around the world, it'll be interesting to see if the dynamic and the tone changes now that it's just another corporate event. It's like going to a sportsman show somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be interesting. I mean, it was probably too new to notice that at Flagstaff this year, but it'll be interesting to see after this season going into next year, if there will be a lot of changes. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to watch.
Well, I was critiquing my time at Overland Expo West because it was their first event under the new management. And I actually saw more people that I've known and got to know over the years at this particular event than the last five.
Yeah, that's great.
Everybody was there.
Nice.
But as I think you and I
talked, were there, Ray.
I was there. Yep. Right. I always get down to support all my buddies down there. So that's always a good time. It's a weekend escape for me.
Yeah. So Ray, back to you. Our guest, with all your travel, do you have any rituals? Like, do you have a first meal that you always make at the start of a journey?
Not really. I mean, so the nature of the way we travel is different from a lot of folks. We try to go pretty simplistic. I finally broke down and bought a fridge recently, but that's basically for just carrying beer and ice in. But you know, when we drove like London to Singapore, we didn't have a fridge with us. We didn't even have a cooler with us. Right.
You hear that, people?
So we just ate whatever the locals ate as we traveled. And that was great. I mean, that we learned so much about the local culture and cuisine and people and languages as we traveled, because we were forced to, right? When you're sitting in your rig and you've got your own food with you and you don't really need to get out and interact with people, it changes the experience. But when you're forced to find food three times a day, it really makes you interact. And I mean, I remember one day we were driving through Iran and we were in some little tiny village. And, you know, it's pretty late in the day and, you know, no food in my truck, right? I mean, there's a few cans of, you know, non-perishables in the back for emergency, but, you know, not a lot of food. And so we drove into this village and, you know, there was no market. There was no place to buy anything that I could see. So I got out and I started speaking to some of the locals and I had, you know, Google Translate on my phone and I'm saying, where can I buy some food? And I was pointed to a house. And it just looked the same as all the other houses. And I mean, there was only 20 houses in the village, right? But there was one house that go knock on the door. I knocked on the door and showed them like my little translation app that said, I want to buy some food. And the owner of the house brought me into one of the rooms And in that room, they had it set up like a little mini mart. And I didn't recognize 95% of what was in there, but I still just randomly bought a bunch of stuff and brought it home and opened it up and go, oh, look, these are beans. And, you know, and so we went and camped and cooked, and it was fun. Right. And it was a great experience. It's something we wouldn't have experienced if we had have been carrying a bunch of supplies with us.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, we do try to just graze as we go. So yeah, no, I guess it is kind of a tradition in that we go out and we find what we can find as we go, and we kind of celebrate, okay, look what we're eating tonight. This is kind of cool. Not expected. So
would you recommend other travelers to do that?
Oh yeah, I think so. Well, you have to be the type of person who likes to try a lot of different food and not be squeamish about what you're eating. And you also need to, you know, be the type of person who's like, this is terrible, but I'm going to eat it anyway, because it's all I have, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes beggars can't be choosers, right? So you have to go, all right, tonight's dinner is this weird dried mystery sausage that was hanging in the window and these unmentionable vegetables that I don't recognize. But that's okay. We'll chop them up and make something. So, yeah. But if you are adventurous with your food, I think it's a great way to go. And when you start forcing yourself to eat the local food, then everybody locally wants you to try stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of fun. Because then everybody, you start buying things, and then the local people in the grocery store will say, well, if you're buying this, you got to buy this sauce with it. You got to try this with this. And they start kind of teaching you how the local cuisine works. And that's a ton of fun if you like to cook.
So I think it's obvious what the immediate benefits are of doing something like that. A good meal, meeting new people, the euphoria of doing this on a trip. Are there any long-term benefits that you've received from traveling like that?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things is we try a lot of different food now. We were exposed to stuff we never would have tried in the past, and now we love it. In Iran, we found all these wonderful ways that people would pickle things. And it's different from the pickled vegetables you get in India or the pickled vegetables you get in the UAE. I mean, the kind of the Persian pickled vegetables, they're very distinct. And we fell in love with them. They were so good. Some of the families that we met, they would give us little jars of home pickled vegetables to carry with us to the next town. And you know, so we're on the lookout for that kind of stuff now when we travel. In Myanmar, it was really interesting. Everybody eats family style. If you go to a restaurant or something, nobody orders just individual dishes. Everything just comes communally. And there'll be big pots of rice, and you'll have people who walk around and they're scooping rice out for everybody in the restaurant, right? Just communally. And you order little meat dishes and you pay for the meat dishes, but together with the rice is like probably a dozen or so vegetable dishes that people just scoop out and let you try. So we learned all these new dishes, which we just fell in love with, and we never would have tried them otherwise. Right. I mean, it's there. It's on your plate. Somebody just puts it there. And so you try it and you go, wow, this is surprisingly awesome. So, yeah. So I think, you know, our appreciation for a lot of different flavors and foods definitely increased. In Southeast Asia, there's a lot of fermented food. And at first, if you're used to a Western palate, fermented foods can take a little while to get used to. But once you start to appreciate them, they're really, really good. So now I actually make some of my own fermented chili paste and stuff at home, which good is for your, cool.
They're good for your gut health, too.
They are. Yeah.
So we like to get philosophical around here. You've had a lot of life experiences. You've had an opportunity to travel the world. You're at a stage in your life where you have a family, you have you're about to be an empty nester. What do you wish you had known when you started out?
I don't know. Honestly, it's kind of one of those classic questions you get asked. But if I had known anything in the past that I know today, I probably would have done things differently. And if I had have done anything differently in my life, I wouldn't have arrived at where I am today. So every good experience and every bad experience I've had along the way has led me to where I am. And so, you know, I think if I was going to, you know, go back and tell my, you know, 20-year-old self, you know, a life lesson, I would say, don't worry about things so much, right? Mm-hmm. You know, some things you're going to have some terrible days and that's okay. You know, don't worry about it. It's like, you're just going to get to the end of it and go, well, that was a terrible day. Let's hope tomorrow's better.
More Land Rovers, more trips.
Right. So is that a question, Phil? I would say, you know, the ideal thing would be to have more trips. I mean, I have a lot of Land Rovers because I have a soft spot for them. I'm not necessarily trying to collect Land Rovers, but I hear about people who are like, yeah, so I sold my house. I've got these two old Land Rovers and, you know, I can't get rid of them. Or I'm just going to get them scrapped. I'm going to get somebody to take them off and crush them. And I'll be like, whoa, hold on. Right. And I'll go and I'll get my flatbed out and we'll go rescue a couple of Land Rovers. My wife refers to my house as the wayward Land Rover sanctuary these days. But yeah, I'm always looking for somebody who wants to take a couple off my hands and, you know, kind of get them back on the road again. So it's kind of like that old watch ad, right? Where it says you'd never really own it. You're just a caretaker for the next generation. Right. So yeah, I'd love to hand off some of my Land Rovers to somebody else and get back out on the road and travel again. I'm actively trying to simplify my life. My problem is my kids are not yet at the stage where they're in a position for me to hand them a bunch of Land Rovers. So hopefully soon.
You're not really a gear-centric person from looking at your rigs, but in the last 12 months, what would you say is the best investment in gear that you've made?
Probably a Overland Solar. I bought one of their little panels, the little solar panels that folds out real, really small. Their little bug out panel. That's been great. I really like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't buy a lot of gear. I mean, you look at the gear that I've had that I use every time I go on a trip, most of it's 10 years old, 15 years old, right? You know, I've got some tents, my little ground tents, which I most of my tents are from Nemo. I've got an old spring bar. You know, they're good quality tents. They'll last for a decade or two decades, right? Same thing with, like, you know, my sleeping pad and my sleeping bag and that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, my cooking gear is super simple. I try to kind of keep everything simple as much as I can. My stove is one of those little MSR Dragonflies. Not sure if you're familiar with it, but it's, you know, it's a little camp. It's a backpacking stove, and I love it because it's multi-fuel. So I run mine on gasoline, right? So anywhere I can buy unleaded, I can refill my stove, right? Which is fun, and yeah, so just super simple stuff like that. I've got the same pot that we've used for, you know, 20 years. And, you know, I don't buy a lot of gear. I buy tires. I seem to go through a lot of tires.
I think another good question for a well-traveled person like you is, when you're actually on the road, on a trail, driving, what's your favorite type of geography? Mountain, desert?
Honestly, I don't have a favorite type of geography. I love it all. I love driving along the coastline. I love getting into the mountains, treed areas, big sweeping grasslands. It's all gorgeous to me. My favorite thing is finding old two-track trails or the remnants of trails that, you know, everybody in the Explorers Club, for example, typically has an area of specialty that they like to focus on. And mine is ancient roads. And I like to find these old roads through the wilderness because, you know, anytime you find an old road, you know, nowadays it's not that hard to build a road, but anything more than 50 years ago, building a road was a big job. Mm-hmm. And if somebody was going to take the time to put a road in, it went somewhere. There was a reason for that road. And so I love finding these old roads that appear to go to nowhere on the map and follow them to their terminus and figure out, what was this road for, right? Was there an old logging camp up here? Was there mining? Was there a city? Was there a dock, right? I remember I was in Tulufan, on the China-Mongolia border one time, and I found this old road that was kind of cut through the rocks, and I followed it, and it eventually just kind of petered out, and I didn't know where it went. And then we found there was these caves that one of the locals was explaining to me that go down into the hillside, and there's underground rivers that run through the desert there. And that area of you know, kind of the Chinese border area, is famous for their green grapes. They export these green grapes all around the world to make raisins, and they're fantastic. But, you know, you'd be like, grapes are such a water-intensive crop, and this is the middle of the desert. How has this industry been here for thousands of years? It's because of these underground rivers. And so they've cut like tunnels and staircases into the rock to go down to where the rivers flow under the desert. It's really cool. But again, I would never would have known about that if I hadn't said, where does this old road go? Right. And it, like, nobody was driving the road anymore. But if you look at it and you kind of squint your eyes, you go, I think that used to be a road at one point. And, you know, if somebody's taken the time to cut a road through somewhere, there was definitely a reason for it. There's some amazing roads out there. There's one I want to do, which is called the Elephant Trek through Saudi Arabia. And when the Ethiopians tried to invade Mecca, you know, 2,000 years ago, well, 1,700 years ago, somewhere in there, you know, they came across the point of land which is closest. And then as they worked their way up the mountains, there was an old, like a footpath that went through the mountains that would, you know, take them up the gulf. And they had war elephants with them. So the head of the army, he sent like guys with chisels, like hundreds or thousands of guys with chisels and hammers ahead of the army to widen the road so the elephants could pass through. And that road is still there, right? Like chiseled by hand through the mountains. I mean, you know, things like that, that's the kind of stuff that inspires me. I'm like, one day I want to drive that road through the mountains, or at least walk it or take a bicycle through or something, right? But I mean, like just experiencing that level of history. When somebody builds a road somewhere, it's definitely going somewhere. And you can imagine in your head what that road was used for.
So that may be your answer, but that made me want to ask you, what's currently on the top of your bucket list or for adventures? Is that it?
Oh, I don't know. I've been kind of tempted by boats lately, so much to my wife's chagrin. But no, I don't know. I want to go out and drive. I want to do coast to coast on dirt with the wife, but I don't want to take a truck. I want to take like our little Toyota Corolla. We've got like a 1990 Toyota Corolla station wagon, little two-wheel drive one. And I think that would actually be a lot of fun. I want to kind of do a little bit more of the overland light type of travel. So, you know, $1,000 car, camp stove, little tent, and just go and explore and, you know, not worry too much about the gear and the things and the vehicle, and just kind of focus more on the people and the trip and where you're going. And, you know, and if the car's a little bit inappropriate at times, well, that's all part of the adventure.
So Ray, you've been interviewed a million times. Is there something that I should have asked that I didn't know to ask you?
I don't think so. Nothing that I want everybody to know, that's for sure. No, I think I'm pretty lucky. One of the things, like I think, you know, the fact that I was inspired by my dad and my grandfather to explore. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I've been really happy with, is that, you know, my kids seem to be inspired as well. So it's nice to see that that being carried on into the next generation. And it's I think the other thing, you know, that we haven't talked about, which I think is a key thing, is a lot of times, you know, we think of ourselves as explorers or travelers as individuals, but, you know, most of the time we're part of a family unit, right? And recognizing that, you know, your partner is going to be going along with you typically, and recognizing there's a lot of differences there, you know. So just when I was thinking about family, that kind of popped into my head. You know, my wife is the exact opposite of me in almost every way. And we're, you know, we're going to go drive around the world. And the morning of our trip, I'll wake up and I'll go, I guess I should get a tent or something and throw it in the truck before we go, right? And my wife will have, she'll be mapping lists. She'll have spreadsheets, you know, a month ahead of time where she's saying, these are the things we're going to need. And this is, you know, and those two personalities will clash, aggressively, right? At times. And so, you know, that's a big part of it. If you want to get out there and start exploring as a family unit, you need to recognize how you're going to make that work. Right. It's not easy. You know, and everybody who looks at pictures on Instagram of happy family travelers, you know, wow, they look like they're having so much fun. They do in the pictures. Right. But there's a lot of unhappiness in there too. Right. And I think some people just need to recognize that, you know, there's, you know, it's still real life. Right. So if you want to go out there and start exploring, recognize that there are days where it's going to be terrible, and just recognize that eventually you'll have more good days than bad days, right? You'll get better at it.
So it sounds like you're saying that in the pursuit of happiness, buying a Airstream or a Mercedes-Benz van and getting an Instagram and YouTube channel to be rich is not the answer.
I don't know that anybody's going to get enough money through Instagram to pay for their Airstream. I'm guessing there's probably a few out there, right? But I think, you know, it should be about traveling and doing what you want to do because it's what you want to do, not because of what people are going to think about when they watch it, right? We did our London to Singapore trip and a film crew wanted to, a TV production company wanted to send a crew with us, right? They wanted to send like 8 guys and in a couple of trucks to kind of follow us on this trip. And I mean, they were going to pay us a decent amount of money. It would have paid for the trip. And so my wife and I talked about it. And at the end of the day, we decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're not really going to document our trip other than just family photos and stuff, because we want it to be our trip. We want it to be something we're doing with the family. And if we bring a film crew along, it just becomes a production. And, you know, you lose that authenticity, you lose those moments as a team or as a couple or as a family. So I think sometimes it's good to kind of step away from the gram and just keep those moments for yourself.
How does someone find you on social media, and how does someone find out more about your rallies?
They can just look up Ray Hyland on social media. I'm one of those guys that just uses my own name on the internet, so I don't have any fancy tagline or anything. And then for the rallies, just look up, you know, the bcoverlandrally.com or the northwestoverlandrally.com. They'll both they'll redirect you to the one central website, which is overlandadventurerallies.com.
Is there anything you want to ask Mike or say?
No, it's fascinating. I love the attitude, just get out and do it, because that's pretty much what I say all the time. It's not about the stuff. It's about doing it.
Drive what you got.
So, Mike, what are your plans? You said you're going to Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Any other news you want to break? Have you started releasing your videos on the build that you're doing?
Not yet. Next week, I think, is going to be the first video coming out on the new build. And they'll be coming out every week after that.
That'll be on your channel, correct?
That'll be on the Drive the Globe YouTube channel, correct? Yep.
Yes.
It'll be hopefully I'll be wrapped up building it anyways in time for the fall season.
Nice. That should be fun.
It's fun.
Ray, we are very particular on who we have as guests. We only like to have what we call real ones. We consider you a real one. So we appreciate your time. We appreciate you being a part of the podcast. And is there any last words you want to say before we go?
Not really. I mean, if I was going to sum up the whole thing, you know, is I would use our rally tagline, which is have fun, make friends, learn stuff. So, you know, it's not just a tagline for the rallies. It's kind of a tagline for travel, right? Just get out there, have fun, make some friends, learn some stuff along the way.
Absolutely. And guys, you know what I'm going to say. Stay safe, tread lightly, and hopefully I'll see you here or on a trail soon.
You have been listening to Waypoint Overland's Random Waypoints. Like, subscribe, and stay tuned for more.